So I'm here to talk to you about work that I've been doing with students and collaborators that I've listed here on the slide. And I've tried to make an emphasis to highlight student work, in particular the work of my graduate student, Jordan Van Nest, whose thesis that I've been editing all day today, because he's defending in a month. So I'm going to talk to you about galaxies. And for the purposes of this talk, we can think of galaxies as gravitationally bound collections of stars, dark matter, and gas. The stars and gas I'm going to refer to as the baryons in the galaxy. And we have a really beautiful rendition of, artist rendition of our Milky Way galaxy. But you'll notice that around our Milky Way galaxy, there are smaller galaxies. So any galaxy that is smaller than the Milky Way by mass, I am calling a dwarf galaxy, okay? And you can have different types of dwarf galaxies, as you can see in this artist rendition, right? We can have blobby ones, we can have really tiny ones that you can barely see, and then we can have disrupted ones that are disrupted by the gravitational potential of the host galaxy. So galaxies that are caught within the gravitational potential of a host are satellite dwarf galaxies. And galaxies that are not caught in the potential of something else, I'm going to refer to as isolated dwarf galaxies. So our brightest, closest friends are the LMC and SMC that you can see in this artist rendition. I'm going to be talking a lot about different dark matter models. The majority of the simulations that you'll be hearing about in this talk are LCDM simulations. For this audience, I didn't think that there would need to be too much introduction to what LCDM is. So we think dark matter is non-baryonic. It's made out of something else other than protons and neutrons. In CDM, dark matter is cold, meaning it's not moving very fast. Okay, it's dissipationless. It has no way of cooling. So its collapse is halted by virialization. And it's collisionless in the sense that it only interacts via the gravitational force. And in the hierarchical model of the assembly of the universe, we think that this is a simple model that describes many scales and that it's self-similar across all of those scales, from the largest scales to the smallest scales. So the tool that I use to study dwarf galaxies are cosmological N-body simulations, N-body plus SPH simulations. And in particular, I use the Marvelous and DC Justice League dwarf galaxies. So what the Marvelous dwarf galaxies are a set of four simulations where I've chosen a volume of the universe that is very isolated, meaning there is nothing within a megaparsec of these dwarf galaxies that is Milky Way size or larger, okay? And this is simulated to have just basically cosmic sheets of dwarf galaxies. So we have small dwarf galaxies, the satellites around them, but nothing big. Then we have the DC Justice League, which is a whole other environment. And in particular, it's the environment around a Milky Way. So each of the four Milky Ways that are simulated are named after the first four women Supreme Court justices, thus the DC Justice League, and thus my terrible Photoshop skills. So I put this in as like a temporary image, and now everybody in the whole collaboration uses it. And so I find it slightly embarrassing that I didn't do a better job. And so then we have simulations of dwarf galaxies in another environment, in the environment of a Milky Way, and in the regions around it that might be pre-enriched, for example. I won't have time to talk about the Romulus simulations, but if you're interested in large volume simulations that probe all the way down from 10 to the 13 solar mass halos to, you know, dwarf galaxies. And talking about dwarf galaxies in a statistical sense, you can ask me about the Romulus simulations. So if I combine the Marvel dwarf volumes and the Justice League dwarfs, I have 211 dwarf galaxies that range in mass from slightly more massive than the LMC all the way down to ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. So I have this lady saying, wow, because back when dinosaurs roamed the Earth and I was doing my PhD, my whole thesis was on 16 simulations of dwarf galaxies. So this is just so wild to me. And this is like quadruple the resolution. And so I'm not going to talk about this particular plot quite yet, but I just wanted to show you the vast, what 211 data points looks like in simulations. And so if you're interested in doing any kind of dark matter work on simulated dwarf galaxies, we have the sample for you. We probe all the way down to a V-band of -2. So we are probing deep within the ultrafaint dwarf galaxy range. Let's see if my movie works. You can do it, movie. There we go. So in this movie, we're going to see the formation and evolution of a dwarf galaxy on the order of the size of an LMC. And in particular, green is dark matter, and everything else is hot gas exploding out of the protogalaxy. And so the reason that I like to show this video is because it shows you how violent the process of galaxy formation is, even within these tiny dwarf galaxies, right? An LMC is not a very deep potential well. It's not a very, that was probably me, sorry. It's not a very large galaxy, and yet your screen in this movie is getting filled up with the hot gas that is ejected by what's called feedback, okay? So in mass, the majority of a dwarf galaxy, or any galaxy for that matter, is dark matter, but dwarfs are highly dominated by mass and dark matter. Feedback is basically the process of galaxy formation, and it can imprint itself on all three components of a galaxy.
Is the feedback here AGN or supernova?
This is a dwarf galaxy that does not have a massive black hole in the center, so it's just supernova feedback. Yep. So all feedback mechanisms have three things in common. Right? They heat the gas within the galaxy. They drive the gas out of the galaxy in the form of what are called galaxy outflows. And as a result of heating the gas and throwing the gas out, they're suppressing star formation within that dark matter halo. And in dwarf galaxies, you can have three main branches of feedback. You can have stellar feedback, so winds from massive stars. You can have supernova feedback, as well as black hole feedback. So we do include black hole feedback in our dwarf galaxy simulations. That could be a whole other talk. So if you have questions about that, I have hidden slides, so you can ask me later. But in particular, the black holes, massive black holes don't form in every dwarf galaxy and are not the dominant source of feedback in these dwarf galaxies. So I've highlighted in red the two sources that are most important. And we need feedback in order to form realistic galaxies. If we want to make galaxies that have the correct observational properties, like the correct stellar mass, the correct metallicity, both gas phase and stellar metallicity, if we want to get the right colors of our galaxies, we need to be able to model this feedback really well.
The basic question of black hole and supermassive black hole.
Yes.
Is there stellar black hole? Do they have
So the resolution of the simulation isn't going to capture stellar mass black holes. So for example, a star particle is on the order of a few hundred stellar masses, and so it represents some sampling of the IMF and not individual black holes. Does that make sense? Cool. So dwarf galaxies got popular in the last decade because they offered some challenges to the LCDM paradigm, which are called the small scale challenges to CDM. So,
so you mentioned the IMF, right?
Yes.
What's assumed for the mass function of the stars?
We assume a Krupa 2001 IMF for the mass function of the stars. As the resolution goes down, we can stochastically sample that IMF, because the star particle masses are getting really low. So we have a way of statistically sampling so that we don't have like half supernovae or anything like that going off. Is that your question?
I've seen some papers, you know, claiming that the IMF systematically is different for like big galaxies and small galaxies, you know. I think in the sense that in like small galaxies, it's supposed to be more top heavy instead of bottom heavy.
So that comes from this H alpha to UV star formation indicator stuff. And so basically, I'll just draw the picture. If you look at M star as a function of SFR from H alpha over SFR from UV, at higher, more classical dwarf masses, they're relatively in agreement. And then as you get to lower masses, you get a lot of scatter. And so people like Pavel Krupa thought that this was due to the fact that there is a differing IMF in these low mass systems. But this could also be due to the fact that dwarf galaxies are extremely bursty in their star formation. So depending on where you're catching it in a burst, you're actually going to, you can induce that scatter. So there's work by Dan Wise that looks at this. And then there's work by Mark Krumholtz using his slugs code that also looks at this. And so I'm actually writing an NSF proposal to look at this at really, really, really high resolution to see once we resolve the multiphase ISM in some of these dwarfs, can we actually test this hypothesis of it just being where you're catching things in the burst? So that's a good question. So my thesis of this talk is that there's no small scale crisis for CDM. And so these in the challenge column are all the supposed small scale challenges to CDM. And if you add baryons to CDM, that messy, gross, horrible process of galaxy formation upon which I've built my career, you can solve the majority of these small scale problems. This one has a question mark because it depends on who you ask. And planes of satellites is just contentious across the board, so I didn't want to make anybody upset by putting any check marks. But I always tell people that I'm agnostic to dark matter model. I'm not married to CDM. CDM is what I grew up with, right? CDM is what we all grew up with. But there are some really great successes of alternative dark matter models, including both warm dark matter and self-interacting dark matter. And you can see that on this scorecard that you have in front of you.
So what does diversity mean in this context?
Yes, so that I'll talk about in gory detail towards the end of the talk, but it essentially refers to the fact that in a very particular mass range, you can get very peaky rotation curves and very flat rotation curves, and that's difficult for CDM. So this is great, but you know, with baryon, CDM solves all the problems, so why should we care about other dark matter models? Well, you add the messy stuff into all the dark matter problems, they all solve all the problems. Crap, right? What do we do from here? Pardon my language. And so this is why I say there is no small scale crisis, but I'm agnostic to the model because with baryons, all of them solve all the problems. So the question becomes, you know, is there a way for us to differentiate? And so before I get into this, I wanted to highlight some work that we've been doing on the cuffed core problem, which I'll briefly describe to you guys, but I assume most of you know what this is. But basically, if we take a slice of a galaxy in log R versus log density, we expect from spherical collapse the red NFW profile, which has a steep inner slope. But what we actually observe in dwarf galaxies are a very flat cored inner slope. And so that can be caused by exotic dark matter, like warm or self-interacting dark matter, but it can also be caused by feedback. And so this was from a series of paper from Andrew Ponson and Fabio Governato back when I was still a PhD student, which basically says that the process of forming stars, blowing up your supernovae, drives gas in outflows out of your galaxy, and that fluctuates the galaxy's potential, and as a result, the dark matter's orbits move outwards, and because the process of relaxing back and getting that gas back is very slow, the orbits never return. And so you're slowly, with bursty feedback, pushing dark matter out of the center, turning a cusp into a core. I just really like this figure. And so you can see this in this kitschy movie, where as the dwarf galaxy evolves, we can watch that inner slope go from cuspy into a cored inner slope. And so what two of my PhD students are studying is the relationship of bursty star formation and the formation of cores, and how that depends on your feedback model. So supernova feedback in our simulations is what's called a subgrid model, meaning it's below the resolution of our simulation. And so we have to rely on prescriptions to model that feedback. So what was canonically used for a really long time was blast wave. But while that is somewhat physical, trying to model the Taylor-Sadov solution to feedback, the superbubble feedback model is much better. It captures processes like conduction as well. And so what they were looking at is how bursty star formation histories are in the Marvel dwarfs versus how cored or cuspy a galaxy is. And looking at that is a function of stellar mass as well. And as you can see, both feedback models have a trend where the burstier the star formation history, the more cored your galaxy is. But that trend has a lot more scatter in the blast wave model than in the superbubble model. And so in their paper that's coming out, well, I told them it should be submitted by the end of the semester, so we'll see. They are exploring the reasons behind that.
Is there some reason, for the more bursty galaxies to also make more stars?
It's not that they make more stars. It's just that they're in that sweet spot of stellar to halo mass, where the fluctuations are particularly efficient at moving dark matter outwards. So if you don't have enough star formation, so the more massive galaxies live in the more massive halos, but they're in this very specific sweet spot of stellar to halo mass that is particularly efficient at forming cores. So if you were to extend this up and include Milky Ways, it would drop back down.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I missed that. What's the model left? What's the difference?
They're different supernova feedback models. So this one is tied to modeling the Taylor-Sadov solution to supernova feedback. And this one is actually trying to model the hot superbubbles that come off of these explosions. So this one's more physically motivated. Though for a decade, blast wave was adopted in the literature. But it relies on an artificial parameter to like turn off cooling for a certain amount of time. And that was not looked upon fondly. So we had to get a little smarter. Yes?
Does this assume historicity or?
I totally missed the question.
Assumes sphericity of like the explosion.
In the superbubble, it does not, from what I recall.
And does that matter?
I'd have to reread the superbubble papers, but I don't think so. So the other thing that can result from the fluctuations of the potential that drive the formation of cores is a formation of radial age gradients in your dwarf galaxies. So in the same way that you're pushing the orbits of dark matter outwards, you're also pushing stars outwards. So stars that were born earlier are going to be fluctuated out to the edges of the galaxy, whereas stars that were born just now are going to stay in the center. Okay, and so you wind up forming a young to old age gradient. And so what my former undergrad, who's now a PhD student at Rutgers, is writing her paper on is on looking at these age gradients as an indicator of cored versus cuspy galaxies. And so in this first plot here, we're looking at the age gradient. So DT90 is a measure of the age gradient. And then here we're looking at the dark matter core slope, where flat is zero, and -2 is very steep. And you can see that we have the expected trend through here of if you have an age gradient, you have a core. If you don't have an age gradient, you don't have a core. But there's this blob of stuff here that has no gradient, but we can measure a core. And so it turns out that if we look at the age gradient as a function of recent star formation, okay, all of these galaxies have had very recent star formation, and that recent star formation is hiding the age gradient. And so if you've had recent star formation in your dwarf galaxy, it can hide the radial age gradient in your stars, but it doesn't mean that you don't have a core in that galaxy. And this was also reproduced in Grouse et al. 2019. I'm glad I wrote it on the slide because I'd forgotten the author name. And then we've also compared this to observations in this particular paper down here. So for both age gradients and metallicity gradients in these dwarf galaxies.
Seems like you have a lower cutoff on the ratio, right? If everything is above.
Sorry?
I mean, the cost seems to have a threshold or a line. Everything has to be above the ratio of the gradient versus
cost. So this also has a slight environmental effect that Claire is writing about in her paper. And so as you, if I recall, sorry, I haven't looked at this plot in a while. As you get closer, so we have stars versus circles. Stars are satellites, circles are centrals. Empty circles have had no recent star formation. As you move away from the dwarf or from the host galaxy, that does something to the age gradient as well in recent star formation. I just can't remember off the top of my head. I can pull up the plot later. And so I think that has something that has more to do rather than a specific ratio. But it's in these high mass galaxies where you have continued star formation that you can have recent star formation to even erase your age gradient, if that makes sense.
So if you split those galaxies based off of earthiness of the star formation, do you see any difference?
That is on our to-do list. Yeah, so those two papers are tied together very closely. So the key problems that I'm trying to address with my work and my students' work is, can we continue to understand the formation and evolution of galaxies in this vanilla CDM and baryons model? And then, as I said before, with baryons added, all of them seem to solve all the problems. Are there any ways of distinguishing? And so we'll start with key problem number one. Can we continue to just use CDM? Can we continue to use the model that we all grew up with? So why do we care? We care because of this figure here by Josh Simon, where he's showing as a function of time the discovery of dwarf galaxies, and you can see that in the advent of digital surveys, it blasted up basically within the last decade. And most of those that we've been discovering are what are called ultrafaint dwarf galaxies, where most people tend to define them as having a stellar mass below about 10 to the 5 solar masses. Some people defined it based on V-band magnitude being less than 8. To 6-ish, depending on the author. But what I want to really drive home is that this is important for the future because we have JWST online now, and we have Ruben and Roman coming up. So we're going to be finding more and more of these, and we're going to be expanding out of our local volume. So right now, we're very localized in what we can find, but with both Ruben and Roman, we'll be able to find fainter things in our neighborhood and expand out of our local volume and find these isolated dwarf galaxies at fainter and fainter masses. So ultrafaint dwarf galaxies, why are people excited about finding them? It's because we assume that they're really simple systems. We assume that they're so tiny that they started to form some stars and reionization just truncated their star formation histories, because their potential well are so shallow that that's it for them. And so as a result of that, they're supposed to be the least affected by this crazy galaxy formation that I showed you. You know, they only form stars for a generation or two, so hopefully there are pristine systems for studying dark matter. And there are papers out there that tell us that the abundance can tell us something about the dark matter model. For instance, what is the smallest dark matter halo that can host a galaxy? What is the mass function of halos as we probe lower and lower in mass? CDM would expect that, you know, everything's self-similar and we can go smaller and smaller, whereas warm dark matter might have a cutoff. To bring it back to the cusp versus core problem, ultra-faint dwarf galaxies shouldn't have had enough star formation and prolonged burstiness to be able to turn cusps into cores due to feedback. So if we find out that they are cored instead of cusped, then that is a very huge real challenge to CDM. That would point to some other model for dark matter.
Can I ask you about the point of the objects like looking lighter and lighter footprints? Like, but isn't there at some point a cutoff because baryons are just hot, and then below that you don't care about dark matter anymore because what's preventing the baryonic collapse is just the thermal velocity of the baryons, right? And I thought that was already like a 10 to the 5 solar masses, so going fainter and fainter?
Going fainter and fainter could have lensing, so for Roman, finding these systems within streams even, that are these small dark, empty dark matter halos that perturb streams, or we can find them through lensing signals as well. And then there are these, so Beneta Ziyambe is the author of these papers where they find these halos that just have gas in them. So he calls them, they're full of H1, I think. And there are these dark matter halos with just H1 that never could collapse into like an actual galaxy. And he has a whole framework for why that is within the paradigm of CDM and how that might change if you have different transfer functions in the early universe. So finding these, going towards when you find these empty halos is something that's actually really interesting for dark matter studies. All right, so here we are going to look at Captain Marvel. And so we're looking at Captain Marvel in dark matter density and in gas density. And in the gas density, you could really see how it was a sheet, cosmic sheet that we simulated. So we're slowly zooming in on the most massive halo in Captain Marvel, which is an SMC-sized halo. And so you can see the abundance of dark matter structure and the lack of abundance of what actually turns on. But as we zoom in further, you can see the evidence of feedback in those gas shells. And that is just the end of the movie showing you how pretty Captain Marvel is. So I got the initial conditions for Captain Marvel when I was like a last year PhD student and could never get them to run. And so like Captain Marvel, we had to fix a bunch of stuff in the code and its scaling and stuff before it actually would run at the resolution we needed it to. So Captain Marvel's like my baby. So anyway, I test everything on Captain Marvel, which you will see now. So when I finally got Captain Marvel to run with all the appropriate physics, I wanted to study the ultra-faint dwarf galaxy populations, but I did an experiment first. So I took the same initial conditions, the same knobs, and I only changed one of them. I changed the star formation prescription knob. In the MC run that you see out there, I used a very simple prescription for how I form stars. I said, if a gas particle gets X dense and X cold, Y cold, poof, it goes star. And in this H2 prescription, I actually tied the formation of stars to the H2 gas fraction in the gas particle. So it's a little bit more sophisticated. And what came out surprised me. So in these plots, stars are ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. And you can see that in the H2 run, I only predict about two ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. And in this density threshold run, I form 10. So while that might not seem like a big deal. If you go ahead and turn that into predictions for observations, it ends up being a pretty big deal. So I'll start with this one over here, where I'm trying to predict the number of small subhalos around a LMC-sized galaxy. And so for the MC run, which is the density threshold run, there's an almost 50% chance of finding at least one friend around your LMC. Whereas in the H2 run, there's only a 17% chance. And if I go ahead and plot predictions from another simulation group that has its own star formation and feedback models, you're somewhere in between. And so there are surveys that are ongoing right now. Annika Peter is using the LBT to look for isolated dwarf LMC-sized galaxies to understand the mass function of satellites around it. There's a survey called MADCASH that's ongoing looking for something very similar. And so if you're going to make predictions for observations, what the heck is going on here, right? Our subgrid model is beginning to matter. The same thing goes if you go ahead and extrapolate this to a prediction for the mass function. So what I'm looking at is M star on the x-axis, and I'm looking at cumulative number of galaxies with that M star and below, so N greater than M. And if we compare orange versus blue, it's, yes, orange versus blue, that's H2 model versus the density threshold model. As you get further into the ultrafaint range, the gray is the DES discovery space for ultrafaint dwarf galaxies. You can see that those mass functions are diverging, which will change your predictions for dark matter model. So the question becomes, you know, we thought all of our feedback in galaxy formation was this huge success for simulating dwarf galaxies, but, you know, I'm being an Eeyore over here and telling you maybe not. It's because we're finally probing and have the resolution to get into the ultrafaint dwarf galaxy range. So before, in the classical and bright dwarf galaxy range into Milky Ways and higher, you have a process called self-regulation. So I think that's beautifully shown in this paper by Samantha Benincasa, where what she did was she looked at pressure profiles through a galaxy as a function of radius and changed various knobs that we can turn in our simulation. So this has something to do with the energetics of feedback. This has something to do with star formation, and this has something to do with turbulence. And basically, she changed those knobs by a huge amount, and still on average, you're getting the same galaxy. And that's because over a cosmic time, over 13.x gigayears, your choices in these knobs kind of average out. Whereas in an ultrafaint dwarf galaxy, you don't have that happening. You poof some stars, you don't have very many generations, then you shut down. So your choices are very important to the ultrafaint dwarf galaxy, but aren't very important where things can self-regulate. So again, I sound like an Eeyore. I sound like I've talked myself out of a career. And the question here is there a way for us to figure out how to use simulations in this range that doesn't self-regulate? So with my grad student, Anna Engelhart, and a former grad student, Elad Applebaum, we looked into this quite carefully. So we extended the experiment that I ran, and instead of testing just two star formation models, we tested four different star formation models. And we looked at the star formation histories of the ultrafaint dwarf galaxies. So this is the H2 model. You can see that there are a lot of them that form on a delay, and that's because you need some time to form H2. In this density threshold model, there again is some delay. This is where self-shielding is required for stars to form. So again, you have a delay. And then this is if we drive the density threshold really far up. And you can see that some form in distinct bursts, some form as one burst in one population, and some of them have longer or shorter delays in when they form. And that really ties to what I call a phase diagram over here, which is where we're looking at the log of the density of the gas that pooped into a star versus the temperature of that same gas that pooped into a star. And you can see each of these models are turning very different gas into their stars. Okay, and this is all just a function of the subgrid model. And with some work, we figured out that if we look at the metallicity distribution functions of these ultrafaint dwarf galaxies, so all we're doing is plotting as a histogram the metallicity of each of those stars that are in our ultrafaint, and we look at the width of that metallicity distribution function, that might be what distinguishes between these star formation models. So there's a paper by the Edge Group with Andrew Ponson and Martin Ray that points to metallicity itself as being an indicator of the difference between models, but we went even further to think that it's actually the width of the MDF. So people like the Chicago group are working on getting these beautiful CMDs of these galaxies and individual stars' metallicities, and that might be what helps us determine what the best model is for star formation and ultrafaint dwarf galaxies. And this is in addition to the fact that, you know, how do you model a POP3 star versus a POP2 star? When do you turn on type 2 versus type 1 supernovae? Do you have early onset supernovae versus later onset supernovae, et cetera? So there's a lot that needs to be studied in terms of the subgrid models that go into modeling ultrafaints.
Yeah, so I missed. So what's the difference in the classical dwarfs to make them self-regulate, but not, you know, but not these ultrafaints?
It's basically that they have this continued star formation throughout their entire lives. And so the choices you make end up averaging out is the best way to explain it. Whereas in ultrafaints,
so they have continued star formation because
they're more massive, so they're the deeper potential wells, so they can continue forming stars past reionization.
So they always stay, you're saying, they always stay at the threshold for making stars.
Yes.
These things
just shut off.
Stay at the threshold. They
exactly. And then they shut off. So there is not enough time for things to kind of average out.
And is the reason why the classical dwarfs always stay at the threshold, like the reason you said was,
Their potential well is deep enough that they've assembled enough mass by reionization to continue forming past reionization.
Okay.
So I had a...
Observationally, you're saying also, so we see that for big galaxies, or for big halos, they stay near the Chumray star formation threshold, but for smaller galaxies, there's much more scatter.
Yes. Yes. And then.
Because the deeper potential well, the gas falls. It may be exploded out, but it's more like a fountain.
It's more like a fountain. You have a proper baryon cycle. There's also so a former student of mine. She looked at the difference between galaxies that turned on and galaxies that didn't turn on at similar masses. And so if the galaxy was not concentrated enough to assemble enough mass in its center, it remained off. Whereas the galaxy that turned on was concentrated enough and had a mass assembly history that was steep enough. And so that is another thing that ties into this picture. We never got to publish that, though. We have to find a student to do it. All right, so that was me trying not to be an Eeyore, telling you there is hope in observations, which is kind of backwards, right? Theorists are always like, we can make predictions for you, and now we have to sit back and say, okay, observers, we need your help. And the next thing I want to talk about is the stellar to halo mass relationship. And so what I'm showing you here on your left is the total mass at z equals zero, log total mass at z equals zero versus log stellar mass, okay? And then on this, your right-hand side, I'm really struggling with left and right today, I'm showing you log peak mass. So it's the highest total mass a halo ever had in its history. So it's peak total mass, okay? So so things that were, satellites and stripped, I've traced back to find their total mass. And so a lot of the scatter that you see in the stellar to halo mass relationship goes away when you go to peak mass, but you can see that doesn't zero out the scatter. So most of the scatter at Z equals zero is due to dark matter stripping, because as a galaxy falls into its host halo, so all the stars on there are satellites, you're gonna strip 99% of dark matter before you even strip a single star. But I measured the scatter in the kind of intrinsic stellar to halo mass after I've taken out the effect of tidal and ram pressure stripping. And so what you can see is that there is a growing scatter in this relationship. So up at the top, we have a scatter of about 0.2 to 0.3 dex, which matches the scatter that we see at higher masses. Whereas as we approach orange, which is the ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, our scatter grows to about 1 dex. And the scatter starts to grow at a particular halo mass of about 10 to the 10 solar masses. Okay, so why do we care? Well, first, we have to think about what we can actually capture in a simulation. So a simulation has a very specific resolution. I have a mass resolution of, you know, a few hundred solar masses in these galaxies. That means that if a galaxy weighs less than my mass resolution, I'm not going to capture it in my simulation, right? So if my mass resolution is 200 solar masses and a halo is supposed to be occupied by 100 solar masses, I'm not going to poof into any stars. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a galaxy there in nature. So that's what this plot is showing you. So, you know, different star particle resolutions, what the occupation fraction of halos would look like. But Ethan Nadler in 2020 did some work to get based on the Milky Way environment to constrain the occupation fraction based on observations, and found that every halo down to 10 to the 8th solar masses should host a galaxy. So what we did is, it was constrained. I have to reread it. It's been a while since I've read it. But Ethan used RISA's dark matter only simulations and somehow constrained them based on Milky Way data. I don't quite remember his process.
Matching things like the abundances.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the number of galaxies seen.
Yep.
Like to match the number of subhalos, you
yep.
have to assume that most of them are occupied.
Yeah, and there was a little more finesse to it that I'm not capturing, but I don't recall off the top of my head. But this was like, When we figured this out, we were like, oh crap, do we have a paper, right? If we're not capturing galaxy formation. So we had to get really smart. And so what we ended up doing was using the slope and the scatter of the stellar halo mass relationship we had in our simulations, we stochastically populated the halos down to 10 to the 8 solar masses. And so what that ended up doing was giving us a true stellar to halo mass relationship that was steeper, right? Because we're populating those low mass halos that were below our resolution limit. And there's math in the paper that like justifies how we did it that I don't want to get into here. But if you're interested, it's all in there. And so we have this nice constant scatter down to 10 to the 10 solar masses and this growing scatter that is steeper due to the fact that we populated those halos that were below our resolution limit. And we created this really beautiful online GUI that's on GitHub. There's a link in the paper where you can like choose your own stellar to halo mass relationship, slope and scatter, growing scatter, no scatter, et cetera, and make predictions for the mass function just by like entering it into this GUI. So if you're ever interested in playing with that, it is available. So why do we care about all of this? Well, it turns out that it's going to also affect the mass function that you predict. So again, gray is the DES discovery phase for ultra faints. And with a growing scatter, we compare against constant scatter, which is right on top of no scatter. So what you'll notice is that constant scatter around your stellar to halo mass relationship doesn't matter. It's the fact that it grows that matters that makes the difference in your mass functions. But keep in mind that this is very subdominant to what I showed you when it came to choice of subgrid model. So you can imagine if you extrapolate this out, you can that difference will get more. So as we probe fainter and fainter. The next thing we looked into was environment. And so it turns out that there is an environmental dependence to the stellar to halo mass relationship that we find. So your proximity to a larger halo is going to change your low mass stellar to halo mass relationship. And so you can see this in this GIF that I made. Circles are central, squares are splash back. I can never remember which way is the right way to say it. Galaxies, basically the ones that make one passage. And then stars are true satellites. And you can see that we have that shift in stellar to halo mass as a function of environment. And so this paper should be, Charlotte said she was putting in an archive this week. It's accepted, it's all done, it's in press. So it should be on archive very soon. But basically, if you look at total baryons versus peak virial mass, you have no difference in environment, meaning the baryonic content in these galaxies is not different. But if you look at stellar content, you saw that there was a difference. And so it turns out it's almost like as a function of distance, you're freezing in a certain redshift of stellar to halo mass relationship. So the things that fell in get frozen in time sooner, and the things that are further away don't fall in, so they're not frozen in time. And so that's what Charlotte's paper is going to be showing everybody. But the point of showing you all of that was to say that with these CDM simulations, there's a lot of science to be had, right? CDM works. Understanding baryons is really important, especially if we want to understand ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. I feel like the bearer of bad news every time I give this talk, because ultra-faints, despite being supposedly simple, are actually incredibly difficult to model. But this is going to be very important for Roman, Ruben, if you care about the black holes in these dwarf galaxies, LISA predictions. And so, you know, my big point is galaxy formation is hard. And even in simple systems, it's really hard. But I want to talk about maybe differentiating between dark matter models. Do I have time? Yeah. So what we have done is we have modeled self-interacting dark matter in our simulation with a velocity-dependent threshold. This is an old plot. We've actually interpolated across this, and that mess is gone. But basically, we made sure it matches at cluster data, published rotation curves, and goes a little bit crazy up at ultra-faint dwarf galaxy velocities. And the model that we're using corresponds most closely to a light mediator model. And we look at a Yukawa potential, both attractive and repulsive. Yes?
I like more related to the when you do these simulations, like does the location where the stars form change depends on where you are changing like these parameters? Like whether it's like a deeper inside the halo or not?
So stars will form wherever there's dense gas. And so in dwarf galaxies, the gas is densest the center of the potential. Well, I mean, as the simulation evolves, you're going to change the distribution of the stars. As the simulation evolves, the distribution of the stars is going to change based on mergers, based on feedback, based on all those things. So for instance, feedback can turn a normal dwarf galaxy into an ultra-diffuse galaxy, right? Where you've pushed the stars out by a strong feedback event and you have this really large galaxy. So it's not a static thing that happens.
But that distribution, like that scatter, does it change like when you change the...
Yes, so it can change based on the strength of your feedback, the type of feedback you're considering. So yes. So this is a picture of the diversity of rotation curves problem that I can't recall who asked for, but basically gray is observations. And so you can see that if you look at the velocity at the inner part of the rotation curve versus the outer part of the rotation curve, you get ones that are very strongly peaked and ones that are very not peaked. And simulations don't, in CDM, don't necessarily fill this entire space, especially in the 60 to 100 kilometers per second range. And so what we are doing is we're running what are called the Marvelous Marion Magellanics, because this is on the order of Magellanic size scales, to be able to test whether CDM or SIDM better fills this space. So this is what I was calling the diversity of rotation curves problem. And so the reason we care about that particular space is because this is the space where feedback is very successful at making cores. And so we don't expect to find those very peaky rotation curves, okay? So CDM simulation shouldn't be able to make these very dense galaxies, and that's the diversity problem, because we see them in nature. So these SPARC 2016 observations. And so the hypothesis here is that we are actually able to make these. So these are our new Magellanic simulations in the orange points. And we're actually making these very centrally dense CDM simulations. And we did not expect that. And so Akasha Cruz, Allison Brooks, and I are working on figuring out why. And our running hypothesis, this is like super preliminary. We've just literally these simulations finished a month ago. So this is super preliminary. But we think it goes back to this phase diagram where depending on the type of gas that you're turning into stars, you're going to affect the shape of the rotation curve a little bit. So we're working on this, but we think that the fact that we can actually form these CDM ones has to do with the fact that our subgrid model is forming stars in the coldest and densest gas out of all the other models. So the simulations that couldn't reproduce the diversity all used these two star formation models. And so we think that the diversity problem might be a result of the fact that star formation is subgrid model dependent. So what's really neat is that observers are very excited by this. And so Alexi Leothode and Jenny Green have started what's called the Marion Survey, which is why our simulations are the Marvelous Marion Dwarfs. It's an NSF NOAR Lab survey on DECCAM. They're going to look at 100,000 star-forming dwarf galaxies all within that mass range that I was describing to you, looking at the galaxy halo connection for the LMC, but also trying to understand the diversity of rotation curves and making detailed observations. Vivian Baldessari is also involved in this, so she'll also be looking at occupation fraction of black holes in dwarf galaxies and whether they're active and how active they are. This is like the coolest survey ever. I'm biased, but, you know, and it's called Marion to honor Maria Sibylla Marion, the first female entomologist and naturalist. You can see that we have a theme in the work that we do. The other thing that we're looking at is whether you can distinguish self-interacting dark matter from cold dark matter based on galaxy shapes. So the self-interactions in the centers of halos should sphericalize SIDM halos, whereas CDM halos are going to be more football-y. And so the implication is that the shape of the actual stellar distribution follows the dark matter halo shape. So my grad student, who's defending student, decided to test this. So we looked at the triaxiality of the stellar distribution versus the dark matter distribution. And so black is dark matter, red is stellar distribution. And while there's the same trend in mass, you can see that they don't necessarily correspond or trace each other very well.
So is this because these dwarfs are not supposed to be spirals? Like, they're mostly mostly ellipsoidal galaxies?
We're looking at only the inner part of the dark matter halo when we make this measurement. So we can measure like the moment of inertia tensor and get B over A and C over A as a function of radius for the dark matter halo. And
for a spiral galaxy, expect the shape of the spiral galaxy to be as spherical as.
Sure, but none of these are spherical, or none of these are I mean, maybe down at 10 to the 9.5, you're getting so spirals, but these are not spiral at all. Okay. They're blobs.
And that's the reason
yes.
why you might expect to be something.
Yes.
Okay.
Got it. Sorry, I didn't understand your question. So this might potentially be a problem in using galaxy shapes. And he also looked at, you know, how people measure, the different ways people measure galaxy shapes and whether that matched like the truth we could pull out of the simulations. And so this was following a paper by Zhu and Randall where you could look at effective radius and stellar surface density to infer triaxiality. And so comparing what you pull out of just doing it simulation way versus doing it in the Zhu and Randall way, you can see that there is still disagreement between the methods. And the same thing goes with another observational way following Kato Fong 2021, where basically you have to do a bunch of stacking and some MCMC work to be able to calculate average shapes of galaxies. And they don't necessarily follow what we'd predict from the simulations. So while we were very hopeful that shapes might be the way to go, this isn't looking great. However, we've been doing work with folks at the CCA to better model shapes, not just collapsing everything into this triaxiality parameter. And so we're hoping that that'll be the way to go. So key problem number two, can I find the smoking gun? I'm working on it, but observations make it really, really hard. So with that, I'll end with this pretty movie in the background, highlighting this numerical simulation white paper that we put out for Snowmass that kind of outlines what simulations need to do to start to constrain dark matter. And so with that, I will take questions. Thank you.
Further questions prepared? Yeah, go ahead.
So from what I understand from simulations, the turbulence usually for very massive galaxies are uncontrolled. Like we understand it, we can simulate it. And so is it also true for?
So the turbulence in massive galaxies is what?
Seems to be an understood solvable problem. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a big like a source of confusion when it comes to like predictions or from simulations. Is it also true for dwarf galaxies?
I think most people would say no, that we don't particularly understand how turbulence and, or we don't particularly model well the contribution of turbulence to our subgrid models. So in terms of how stars are going to collapse and where they're going to collapse. So the super zoom in, you know, very isolated simulations can look at that, but with the resolution that we're at, you know, I don't think we're necessarily resolving the turbulent ISM very well.
Too
many? There are a lot. Really depends on what you turn on and off, how many parameters there are. But there's parameters that have to do with the black hole, with your subgrid modeling of the star formation. There's, you know, just different, I mean, there are a lot that you can tune on each of the subgrid models. And so we did, we worked with a statistician a few years ago to try to figure out what the best tuning was. And so we had him work on the problem of, okay, there are these four observable scaling relationships that we need to always make. And here are initial conditions of a bunch of galaxies at different masses. Turn the knobs to specifically make galaxies that fall closest to those scaling relationships. And so he used magic statistics. There's a paper all about it. I couldn't tell you about it, so I call it magic statistics. It was part of his PhD work. And that is how we tuned the big Romulus simulations. And so we try to be smart about the way that we tune things. because we don't want to like tune things to make a good Milky Way and it makes a really crappy dwarf galaxy. And so we try to do things in a smart way, but there's a lot of freedom. But it's less freedom than, say, with an analytic model, a semi-analytic model, depending on who you ask. That's shots fired, I guess. So yeah, you guys got to see underneath the hood a little bit. Any other questions?
So will James Webb, you know, help writing this modeling? Yeah, because you're seeing, like, again, like sort of dwarf galaxies, but not a very high redshift.
Yeah, so my colleague Michael Trummel is thinking about this a lot in terms of high redshift dwarfs. So what are dwarfs at high redshift? And kind of constraining black hole seeding models and some subgrid models to kind of mimic Webb observations. The only thing I've done is, you know, when the first massive galaxies, spectroscopically confirmed really massive galaxies came out, we showed that that was still possible in CDM. But outside of that, I haven't thought about it too much further. High redshift is hard.
Sure.
Dust and all that stuff.
Yeah, observationally.
Yeah.
But in simulation, you just have it.
But if you ask people like Desika Narayan, I mean, there's a lot more that goes into getting high redshift correct, especially in massive galaxies.
OK, great. So Fira will be around, I guess, for weeks and months.
Yeah.
And we'll also, you know, have lunch. Thanks again.
Yep. Thank you.